Our brother Gordon will bring us words of exhortation.
We're really only here for one reason, and that is to remember Jesus. But implicit with the invitation that Jesus gave us is that we should be like him. Today, our readings bring us to Mark chapter 7, where we read the Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus. And it's clear that they gathered around Jesus like a pack of wolves. And they were about to devour him. They wanted to destroy him. They wanted to destroy his ministry. And they wanted to separate the disciples from their Lord. They had come from Jerusalem. They had already heard about the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 plus. There was something, there were things that bothered them intensely about that miracle. One was that the miracle had been performed and that many had followed Jesus as a result. They saw in this man Jesus that there was opportunity. And so he was leading away the people. But there was something else in that miracle that must have bothered them intensely as well. For Jesus fed these people in the wilderness. They ate bread in the wilderness. How could they have possibly observed the ritual of washing in a wilderness? And so when we come to chapter 7 of Mark, the disciples still have bread and even fish in their baskets. The bags that they carried with them always still had some of the remnants, because you remember that they collected up 12 baskets after that miracle. One for each man. And as the Pharisees gathered around Jesus, they could see that these men were dipping into their bags and they were eating without going through the ritual of washing. And so they said, or Mark says that they saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were unclean. Their hands were contaminated. And he defines it, unwashed. And in parenthesis, Mark notes that the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles, and on, and on, and on. So they asked Jesus, why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with unclean hands? And this was surely a strategy to isolate Jesus from the people, to make it very clear that this man was not a true Jew, that he did not observe the traditions of the elders. And therefore, he was not really a part of the true Israel of God. It was at this point that Jesus could well understand and well appreciate that his ministry could fail. His disciples could now leave him forever, turning their backs under the relentless pressure of these Pharisees, these wicked men. And so Jesus unleashed a fury upon them So much so that his eyes flashed with fire, as we can read in the book of Revelation. There is absolutely no doubt that Jesus held nothing back. When he brought out the words of Isaiah, "These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are but rules taught by men." So, Jesus also addressed them as hypocrites. There couldn't be a stronger word that Jesus would use against these men. They were false. They weren't true worshippers of God at all. They had departed from the most fundamental commandment of the Lord God Almighty, that an Israelite should love the Lord his God with all his heart, with all his mind, and with all his strength. They were more concerned about ritual observance. And so Jesus brought out another one to them. He said, "You have let go the commands of God and are holding on to the traditions of men." He said, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. You're pretty good at this," he said. This issue about Corban. "You've come up with this particular thing all by yourselves. It has absolutely nothing to do with the law of God. But it gets you off the hook. And all you have to do with your elderly and failing parents is say to the priest that you are declaring a gift of God in place of having the inconvenience of looking after your parents. And once you have made that declaration, then it is absolutely forbidden that you should look after your parents, otherwise you should be robbing God of that gift." They could designate a sum of money, but they didn't necessarily have to give it all at once, or even at all. You see, it was very important to them that they should do this, because elderly people, people that are failing, can't observe ritual. And if a Jew should have to keep his elderly parents in his home, he would soon become contaminated. Because an elderly man, for example, whose memory was failing, would forget to wash when he partook from the table. And the whole table would become unclean, and therefore the family could no longer partake of the clean food. And older people don't necessarily remain clean. And so a Jew would have to remain in a state of uncleanness, which would be unthinkable. Now we have the conveniences of facilities that look after our older people. But they didn't have that then. The obligation fell firmly upon the family to take these people into their own home, with all of that involved. And of course it wasn't convenient to living a life of ritual. And so this is how they got around it. And Jesus reminded them that they had forsaken the commandment to honor their father and their mother. But then Jesus introduced the teaching about contamination. "It's not what you put in your belly that contaminates you," said Jesus. "It's what comes out of your heart. It's what your mind is thinking about. It's what the mind produces. That's contamination." And the strange thing is that when they went to the house where they were staying, the disciples had to ask Jesus what the meaning of this was really all about. Because the disciples, as you remember, were steeped in this tradition. So much so that Peter, even later, even after Pentecost, had to be confronted by Paul on this very issue of eating with the Gentiles. And when the disciples asked Jesus about this issue, Jesus said, "Are you so dull? Don't you get it?" He was a little annoyed, to say the least, at the disciples' lack of comprehension of this most basic principle. Don't you get it? But then he explained in full, as he did, the meaning of what he was saying to the people at large. "For from within, out of men's heart, come evil thoughts," he said. And then he went on to explain what those evil thoughts were. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. It was at this very point that Jesus had to get out of that area. He had to leave. He had to leave for the sake of his men. For it was a perilous time for them. The Pharisees were unrelenting in destroying his mission. They would not leave the disciples alone, and so it was essential that Jesus should take them away. And for a period of approximately 2 weeks, it would seem, Jesus would take them into Gentile territory up into the area of Syrophoenicia. And here, apart from the time that he would spend educating his men, bringing them around, forging the relationship, showing to them what it was to have a real relationship with the Father, there entered onto the scene this woman, the Canaanite. Matthew calls her a Canaanite. Mark calls her a Syrophoenician. Whatever, she was a Gentile and she was unacceptable to the Jew. It's interesting how Jesus dealt with this woman, how he related to her. And I marvel at Jesus' words and puzzle over them at the same time. Because on another occasion, he deals with a woman in a very similar way, and we would hope to have some time just to look at that briefly. But he says to this woman, "It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." And that was his opening sentence. It was hardly very invitational. It would almost seem confrontational. What was he doing? Was he going to destroy her? But we see how the Lord did it by the end that was achieved. And so she replies, "But even the little dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Matthew's record tells us that the ministry that Jesus indicated to this woman, of which he was about at this time, was that he was to minister to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And who were the lost sheep? But his 12 men. And so it was essential that Jesus spend and dedicate his time to those 12 men. It was hardly fair, he was indicating to this woman, that he should take this time out and dedicate time for her, a Gentile. But he didn't forsake her. She responded And then Jesus said, for such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter. And we can see how much was achieved for this woman. We can appreciate the heart-rending cry that came out of this woman's mouth. As we see the record in the Gospel of Matthew, how that she poured out her heart for the sake of her daughter who was dying. And couldn't something be done for that young girl who was dying? And Jesus brought her to such a level of faith that the miracle of life could be given to the one she loved. She went home and found a child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Is Mark's simple account. And we can see that what Jesus did with this woman was provoke in her, not anger, but loving faith and reliance on him. It brought about a wonderful result. The other incident that has vexed me and troubled me for a long time is the incident that we find in the Gospel of John. Such a well-known one in the fourth chapter of John, at Sychar, the incident at Sychar with this woman at the well. Now Jesus again has to leave Judea. And in verse 4, when he had gone through Samaria, for it was the main road from Jerusalem up into Galilee, he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, for he had just walked probably somewhere between 45 and 50 kilometers, probably that same day, and he was tired. And whether it was noon or whether it was the Roman sixth hour, being 6 o'clock in the afternoon, we can't be sure. I tend to favor the latter because of the length of journey that he undertook that day. And Jesus was sitting on the ground by the well. And a Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, Authorized version, give me to drink. It seems a little blunt. And I've never understood how the Lord, with such lack of courtesy and pleasantry, could make such a statement to a woman. But the results speak for themselves. The woman said to him, you are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? You see, because in what Jesus said, he was making himself inferior. He was the one who was in need, and he placed this woman as the one who would give, as the supplier. And just in that simple statement, he broke down the barrier that existed between the Jews and the Samaritans. Because it was absolutely the rule. The Jews don't speak to Samaritans because they were a mixed race. They weren't the pure stock of Israel. And so it would have been unseemly, particularly for a Jewish male, to speak to a Samaritan female. But Jesus would have none of it. And so when he said, give me to drink, he broke down that barrier. And he allowed her to become the one who would minister. Not him as the superior one. there's a lesson there. It's a lesson on how we can reach other people. But Jesus answered her, and now he invites curiosity. He says, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him. And he would have given you living water. Well, no, she couldn't ask him because she was a Samaritan and he was a Jew. It would have been unseemly for her to have done that. But had she known that she was in the presence of Messiah, there would have been no such barrier. There would have been nothing preventing her from bridging that gap and requesting, imploring him for some of that living water. It wasn't the living water of Jacob's well. Yes, Jacob's well was described as a well with living water because it wasn't still water. It was water that's actually supplied by a spring. And so it was living water. It wasn't just rainwater. It was spring water. It was spring water that kept on springing up. But had you known, you would have asked him. And he would have given you something far superior to this wonderful water so far down in Jacob's well. He's bringing her along. Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? And now the woman was eating out of the hand of Jesus. This is exactly where he wanted her to be, so that he could reach her. And as is so often the way with Jesus, his questions just invite curiosity to take a person another step further. And here she is. Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his flocks and his herds? Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water that I give him will never thirst. There's a lot that had gone on in this conversation that was never said. Jesus read in an instant how empty this woman's life really was. She had nothing. Oh, she had the life all right. She had seven men, and the one she was with wasn't even her husband. So she was perhaps living what might seem to the world at large the good life. But no, she wasn't. She was empty indeed. So when Jesus spoke these words, they hit home and they started to fill his empty soul. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water swelling up to eternal life. How she craved something with meaning. But she couldn't find it. Because all around her was the tradition. And it wasn't just the tradition of the Jews, it was the tradition of the Samaritans. For they, like the Jews, were equally guilty of worshipping their God in a traditional way. They didn't really have a true relationship with the Father. So Jesus used another strategy. After the woman had said, sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw the water, she still wasn't fully comprehending what Jesus had to say to her. And so he said, go call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. And Jesus said to her, you are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you have had five husbands. Sorry, I said seven. It was actually five and then another one. And the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said, or what you have just said, is quite true. And with that she knew that Jesus knew all of the details of her life. There was nothing that could be hid from him. It's the same with us. Nothing's hid. Everything's there. Are we observing tradition? Are we following rules? Are we going through the motions? Are we empty? Or are we drinking from the real fountain of life? That's why we're here. We're here to remember the one who can really quench our thirst. The one who can really supply all of our needs. The one who can give to our life real meaning. I can see that you're a prophet. But there was another problem. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain. But you, Jews, claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. There was controversy, you see. What was right? Was it Jerusalem? Or was it Gerizim? Well, the Jews said, well, it's Jerusalem. The Samaritans said, well, it's Gerizim. Neither was right. Jesus said, believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know and worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. Not the traditionalists. Not the ones who will argue over whether it's Jerusalem or Gerizim. But the ones who will seek the Father in spirit. And what does it mean to seek the Father in spiritual, in spirit? But to be spiritual. For our Father is a spirit. He is a spiritual one with moral values. And we worship him by following those same moral values. The values of the Father who is merciful, long-suffering, quick to forgive, patient. And all of the attributes that the Father has, these are the ways in which we worship. The true worshippers, says Jesus, that we should worship him in spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshippers must worship in spirit and in truth. The woman said, I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I who speak to you am he. And Jesus is speaking clearly to us today. He is the one who has brought us out. He is the one who continues to ask those soul-searching questions of each one of us that will bring us to a realization that only in Him is there truth and value in life. Only in Him is the true fountain of water. Only in Him can we continue to partake and never thirst. It's wonderful how Jesus spoke to those in so much need. These two desperate women, empty, just waiting to be filled. It's wonderful how He ministered to those men in peril, men in peril of being snatched away by the religion of tradition, the religion of do this and do that, that have forsaken the commandment of God, thou shalt love me with all thine heart. We're here to remember Jesus and to be more like Him.